Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, apparently we're sitting on £150 billion worth of savings as a result of the pandemic. But what are we going to do with it all? Invest, save, or splurge? If hot tubs, garden furniture, and offices were so last lockdown, darling, what will we spend our money on next? Doing up your house? You may be in for some long delays. Invest in holiday homes. Staycations might be booming now, but will they last? And if you fancy something more long-term, Simon helps us to spot the investment future trends. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we are chomping at the bit. We are ready to go. Get out there and spend if the figures after the latest easing of restrictions are anything to go by. Queues outside shops, pints in the rain, and doesn't the nation's economy need it? Indeed, it is banking on us spending big. But how much of this supposed 150 billion that we've reportedly saved, not all of us, obviously, by not commuting, going to restaurants, or on holidays, how much of that will we spend? Will we really see a revival of the roaring 20s? Helen, will we? Spending habits have changed somewhat during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. People have got this 150 billion that they're sitting on, which is obviously, like you said, not for everyone, but it's a huge amount of money. I think in the short term, I think there will be a bit of splurging. I think people are just so excited to see things opening up, and, you know, people want to eat out, they want to spend a bit of money in the shops, you know, they want to go to the pubs, sit in a rainy pub garden. So I think, yeah, in the short term, I think people are probably up for a bit of a splurge. But you're right, people have kind of got into this saving habit as well, people who've been kind of lucky enough to sort of still be working throughout the pandemic. And I think to an extent that will stay. Clearly it depends on what you're saving for. So for example, I'm saving for a house deposit, and I think probably in the last year I've saved double what I would have saved in an ordinary year. So clearly I'm going to kind of continue with that. But you know, some people's savings will be kind of more disposable, and they'll be looking at things like holidays and, you know, getting out and about in the world again.
I'm just wondering how many of the habits, things like, you know, ordering food from home, the online shopping, like you said, the savings that we've kind of got used to, will be something that after we've got over the initial rush of seeing family and friends and going for a drink and having some food in a restaurant, will we think, I rather liked what we had before?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the online delivery thing, it is something that people have got very used to. You only have to look at the amount of delivery people out on your street on any given day. You know, people who have really got into ordering things online, whether that's, you know, food, books, just day-to-day household stuff. I think as well, you know, you've got to think a lot of physical retailers and shops have actually closed down during the pandemic, and there probably will be more of that to come. So it might be that people need to shop online more, perhaps out of necessity, because their local branch of whatever retailer isn't open anymore. I think there is room, though, for shops to really up the sort of experience that they give people in the real world. You know, if people are going to go and visit a shop, they want it to be a fun experience. So shops where, I don't know, you can go and sort of try out the products, and it's a bit of a special sort of experience to go there. I think people will enjoy doing things like that. But if it's a choice between, I don't know, ordering a book online and, you know, going to your local Waterstones or whatever, it is just easier to kind of get it to your house, isn't it, if there's no reason to go to a shop.
Simon, what do you reckon? Are we going to go out there? Are we going to splurge?
I think that to an extent people will. And I think that we're already seeing that somewhat. I think that the spending that people are doing in the bursts of time when they've been allowed out to spend has been quite strong. And we had some very strong retail figures from after April the 12th, which was when the non-essential shops were allowed to reopen. The question is whether that's just a sugar rush of everybody going, great, I can get down to Primark, or whether it's going to last. And I think that we keep talking about all these people who are really keen to get out and have a good time and spend, but we also need to remember that there's also a fairly large chunk of people who are still very worried about going out, who are still very scared. A lot of the messaging has been fear factor messaging, because that's what the government felt it had to do in order to keep people at home and drive down the coronavirus case numbers. So it's been a massive psychological experiment, and there's going to be an after effect of that. The question is, will the people who want to get out and spend and enjoy themselves outweigh the effect of the people who are still nervous about staying at home? But then some of those people who are nervous and are staying at home are also spending money on other things that we're going to talk about later on, the whole garden furniture effect, sprucing up the house and all those kinds of things. I think on balance, you are going to get this turbocharging effect for the economy, for the consumer economy, as people go out and spend. I think if we look at a number of points of data, for example, the number of people eat out to help out, people who took advantage of that, the number of people who did go to restaurants and pubs when they were fully open, the footfall at the shops, the number of people who thronged to places like beaches last summer. Now, we can't obviously take a direct read across from last year, because last year we thought summertime, oh, it's all done, we'll be fine now. And then we had the second wave and it got much worse. But then this time around we have the vaccines. So I think in balance it will probably equal a bit of a boom. And I like to be optimistic and think that maybe it will give us the escape velocity to get out of that low growth era, and it will become a virtuous circle that actually improves the economy for the better over the next 5 years, rather than just being something that lasts for 1 year.
Ever the optimist, Simon. Helen, do you agree?
I think, yeah, Simon makes a good point. Maybe this is the kind of kickstart that we need for a bit of economic recovery. But I think as well about the people who've maybe been on furlough on and off, people that have lost their jobs. And I think, you know, the impact of that is only going to become more sort of severe as the government sort of support schemes and things sort of scale back. I don't know. I think there's just room for a bit of caution around, you know, that there are people who are probably still very worried about their finances. And I think the impact of that is going to be sort of greater as we get towards the end of this year.
Before we talk specifically about the things that people are going to be spending their money on next, I think the hot tubs have all sold out. As in your role, Helen, as assistant personal finance editor, we've saved more, some accidentally, some on purpose. And of course, not everybody. But, you know, the debt figures and how much we're paying down of credit cards is also quite optimistic. We, you know, lots of people sort of changed their contributions right at the start to pensions. That seems to have picked up again. You know, it's been a lot of time where we've had to think about our finances. I think some of the scaremongering at the start, some of it justified, you know, maybe I'm not saying it was done on purpose to scare us, but, you know, talking about finances and how many job losses would have inevitably made people actually quite cautious, perhaps looking at their finances, thinking about their finances. Do you think as a result of this, we will sort of inevitably become more savvy about our money?
Yeah, I think people have taken this opportunity to look at their outgoings. It, you know, when big parts of what you spend are completely cut out, so you're not, for example, spending on your commute anymore, I think it does prompt you to look at what you spend on what. And people have been quite sensible. They've put more money into things like pensions. They've reviewed their outgoings and things they perhaps don't need, subscriptions and things like that, purely because they've had time to look into those things. And yeah, I think being a bit more financially savvy is potentially one of the positive results that might come out of this.
Simon, as we know, hot tubs have sold out. Garden furniture is really hard. I mean, I speak from personal experience, hard to get hold of at the minute. So Simon, what are the next big trends in where we're going to spend our money, do you reckon?
We've seen a lot of spending on people's homes. And we're going to see more of that because we've had a lot of people moving home, and people tend to spend money on their properties to a greater degree when they move. There's move and there's improve. We've seen a big wave of improve, and now we're going to see a big wave of move spending. So that's going to be kitchens, bathrooms, redecorating, looking at things like white goods, sofas, all that kind of stuff. I think we're going to see a wave of spending on. We will see, obviously, a dramatic step up in spending on shops, physical shops, going out, pubs, restaurants, etc. Maybe at some point people will be allowed back into the cinema and the theatre and things like that. So you're going to see a wave of money suddenly hit points in the economy. In summer, we're going to see a wave of money go on people going on holiday in the UK, the whole staycation thing, which a lot of people have gone and looked at the scenario of last year, quarantine roulette. They're not quite sure whether they're going to be able to go abroad. They're not quite sure where they're going to be able to go. Some are booking speculatively, but a lot of them are saying, well, let's just stay in the UK. But then they're struggling to find places to stay. But so you're going to see these pockets. It's going to be really interesting to watch these pockets of money start to shift around and then hopefully not be stopped in the way that they were last year, because we had the spending boom through the summer, and then we went into September and all of a sudden you started to get the tightening. You got the rule of six. Then you started to get the tier system and everything like that. So if we see that spending arrive in those waves, in those pockets, it's then going to be really interesting to see how it continues and whether it continues, whether you get continual elevated spending throughout the rest of the year, as for example, in pubs and restaurants, you know, as they open and then can have more people in, and then they have to do less distancing and they get back to the point. I mean, can you imagine going to the pub and the pub was just like normal with everybody packed in? You look at, you watch TV programs, don't you, at the moment? You see people doing things and you think, oh, it's quite nice to just sit at the bar somewhere and have a drink. Or it's very funny. It's going to take a long time to unpick some of the weird psychological elements of this for many people, even for people who aren't overly fearful about it, and even for people who've been vaccinated. And I think we're going to still see a big chunk of people, even when they have been vaccinated, being quite cautious. So as we talked about earlier, it's what end of the pulling on the string moves things.
I agree with you to a point. I do think when we first open up, people will still be cautious. But when you're talking about watching TV, I do notice when I'm watching it now, instantly my mind is going, they're very close. Oh, do you remember doing that when we went to a pub? Automatically, you know, even in such a short time, because let's be honest, a year in my life is actually quite a short amount of time, but already my mind has changed. So just imagine as soon as we open up and we're back to normal, I think those old habits of, you know, bumping into each other and sniffing armpits on tubes will continue if it's allowed to. If we're allowed to, then I imagine those things will come back. I mean, it depends what the impact will be on children. I think it might be slightly different. But broadening this conversation out, Simon, you spoke about what you hope this might achieve for the economy. What will happen if this is not, if people are very cautious, or people have decided, oh, we rather like the amount of money that we've spent and we want to be more cautious because we don't want to go through this again? What will happen to the economy?
Well, the old paradox of thrift, that whereby when a big economic negative impact hits, a recession hits, what people need to do for their individual circumstances is obviously hoard as much money as possible and hold on to it and build up their defences. But what the economy needs is for people to get out there and spend. And I think that we are going to see people spending some of those savings, because I think people consider some of those savings as to be almost like windfall money. But I also think we're going to see a lot of people sit on those savings. And the savings that have been made skew largely towards the wealthier people in society anyway. And there are reams of studies that have been done over the years that shows the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to sit on extra money. Now, you might invest it. You might leave it sat in a savings account, not earning much interest. You might put it into your pension. You might do all kinds of things, but you are less likely to go out and spend that cash than someone who is further down the economic scale. So I think that we will also see more people continuing to save, as Helen spoke about earlier. We talk about the savings habit. There's a reason why we talk about the savings habit. And it's a question of whether they will still be able to save. If you go back to spending £400 a month on your commute, which many people do spend £400 a month on their commute, are you going to be able to have any money left to save? Or are you actually, there is a possibility that people are going to suddenly discover that they've got less money to save because their spending habits have shifted during lockdown. They'll then go back to an approximation of their normal old life and continue to do most of the spending that they used to do in their normal old life, whilst still having slightly higher spending habits elsewhere that they've picked up in lockdown. You know, the obvious example is the takeaways and things like that. But we had a story this week that mentioned the fact that HelloFresh, one of those recipe companies that you get, you know, their business has boomed. These companies like that, recipe companies, craft beer delivered to your door, people spending more on a bottle of wine. So they're buying wine that costs a couple of pounds more each bottle and things like that. Unless you reverse those habits, if you do go back to your old life, you're going to be now spending more and having less opportunity to save. So to sort of go back to something that I've repeatedly said, not to be a broken record, but it's going to be really, really interesting to watch this stuff unfold and see what happens. It is a gigantic economic and psychological experiment in a way.
A very fair point, Simon, that I hadn't really thought about, but I think it happens to me. I'm that you're explaining exactly what's happened to me. And I think I don't feel like I'm saving because I am spending on sort of more things than I used to. But then that's kind of discretionary spending. I'm obviously saving by not traveling. I suppose that's discretionary, but by not commuting, all those sorts of things.
We all have the power to crack down on our discretionary spending, but we find it very difficult. You go back to the whole behavioral psychology and behavioral economics stuff. You focus very much on the most recent thing that you've been doing. And if the most recent thing you've been doing is spending more money on X, Y, and Z, you're likely to continue doing that, as well as going, oh, well, I've now got to spend 400 quid getting to the office and back, or I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And like you say, people will find that quite difficult to unpick. They can unpick it, but just because they can doesn't mean that they manage to.
Oh, Helen, that's thrown something into the mix, hasn't it? Is that what they call sort of lifestyle creep as well? You know, when you get paid more and you start spending more on stuff.
Yeah, I mean, people will always broadly sort of adjust to their means. I think it's interesting that you mention recipe boxes and things like that, because I think a lot of those things rely on sort of spending a lot of time at home. I briefly sort of had a recipe box during lockdown because I could spend the time sort of cooking because I didn't really have much else to do. But I think some of that spending does fall away when you're just not at home for as many hours in the day. I think things like, you know, I'll probably look at cancelling some of my streaming subscriptions and things like that, just because I'm hoping to be spending more time not being in my house. So I think in some ways, the spending on things like commuting and going out will be that will perhaps replace some of the things you would be buying if you were spending almost all of your time at home.
Helen, I just want to ask you before we talk about investing as an alternative option than splurging. What are the sort of stats or figures around where we have actually been keeping this 150 billion? I mean, is it all in rubbish savings accounts? Have we been sort of investing that money instead? Is it just sitting in our current accounts? I mean, where is this 150 billion?
Yeah, and you're right to say that the rates on savings accounts are very poor at the moment. Broadly, the figures show that a lot of people are still keeping their money in those accounts there. There was a survey out from Wealthify which showed that 70% of people with savings weren't confident enough to invest them. So that suggests that a lot of this money that people have saved is sitting in accounts, you know, ISAs and savings accounts, which do at the moment have very low interest. But I think a lot of people are content to let their money sit in those accounts at the moment. Investing, it is a big barrier for people, having the confidence and the knowledge to do that. We have seen people perhaps getting a little bit more involved in investing their money throughout lockdown, partly because of people, again, having time to look into things like that and to learn about it. But for a lot of people, that's something that they're never going to do. So I think, you know, a lot of it is just kind of sitting there, not really accumulating very much interest.
Do you think that the sort of apps like the money boxes and all that sort of thing help?
I think they do to an extent. There's something to be said for, you know, these apps give you prompts and things and they, they'll tell you how much you're saving and how much you're spending on different types of things. I think for some people that really works, you know, for an app to show you, okay, this is how much you spend on this, that will kind of shock them into changing their habits. So it can work. It's obviously kind of geared towards sort of younger people who generally kind of have less money. So it's that you're kind of talking about smaller amounts there. So it can be difficult for something like that to really make a big tangible difference. But, you know, so saving a little bit here and there, those kind of apps that will save your change from when you buy a coffee, you know, every little help, it's worth looking into.
Indeed. All right, well, Simon, if you want to do a little bit more than the odd coffee shop purchase, 2p extra apps, which I'm a big fan of, by the way, and you want to be a bit more hands-on with your investing and you don't want to splurge all your cash, you have some tips on how to predict where the world is heading, Simon, and where to put your money. Is that right? Tanya has been looking, I should say, at the thematic funds to consider sticking in your ISA to make you a fortune in the next decade. Thematic funds, that sounds very posh.
It's exciting, hey? Thematic funds are an interesting one because what you have to do is you have to unpick the overarching theme that's going to shape society as we know it and perhaps provide a tailwind to your investments over the next 5, 10 or 15 years. From the bandwagon jumpers who have seen a fad rolling past the door and gone, ooh, here's an opportunity to make some money from people wanting to invest in this. And it can be quite difficult unpicking some of these things. So let's take, for example, a few individual companies that you could potentially invest in and then consider why it might be a good idea to go for a fund instead. Whether that fund is a tracker, an ETF, you can get funds that simply pick a basket of the stocks themselves and are automated, or whether that fund has a fund manager who's out there trying to pick the best companies and find the ones that are gonna win whilst the others fall by the wayside. So Arrival is a UK-based company. We talked about it a couple of weeks back in the SPAC thing, and it is going to do for buses and delivery vans and trucks what Tesla has done for cars is the argument. It has plans to dramatically scale up from making no electric vehicles other than the prototype that's delivered to UPS to many, many, many in a couple of years with this plan for smaller factories dotted all around the world. People are very excited about Arrival and what Arrival could mean. Obviously, there is a huge market out there for delivery vans, minibuses, coaches, all that kind of stuff, and for them to go electric because governments want everybody to start using electric cars rather than petrol-powered cars. Arrival shares, it was involved in one of these SPACs where it kind of reversed into the US stock market, and the share price, despite all of the excitement, promptly crashed by just over 40%. It's then rebounded really strongly over the last week or so. I think it was on my last time I checked, it was still down about 20% on the float price. But you know, it's been a bit of a roller coaster ride. And with a company like that, you could expect to get involved in a roller coaster ride. Another company, Lilium, people are excited about Lilium. Does flying taxis? Flying taxis might be the future. I mean, they might not be the future as well. There might be no market at all for flying taxis. Lilium, again, that's the kind of company that you could be looking at. That's not actually listed yet, but it could soon be listed. And if you pick any company that's involved in kind of blue sky stuff, so for example, healthcare, immunotherapy, the complete sort of revolution that's going on in biotechnology, that's really exciting stuff. But these companies can, you know, their share prices can swing around wildly. They can be, if they suddenly announce some really good news, it can absolutely rocket. If they disappoint and it looks like the thing that they said they'd do isn't going to happen, they can absolutely sink. So you might be better off, instead of trying to build a portfolio of these yourself and doing all the hard work that goes into that and researching them, is to rely on either a professional or an automated system, at which point the idea of the thematic fund comes in. You're backing big ideas, the kind of big ideas that are going to be the direction that the world takes in times to come. So the best way to explain that is to pick some out. So the first one that Tanya featured in the article, climate change and sustainability. You'd have to be living under a very big rock to have not realized that governments are making a big noise about getting serious about climate change. Joe Biden, the president of the US, the world's largest economy, the world's most important economy, is making a very big deal about this. And we've got this stuff going on all over the place. So can you invest into something, into companies that are going to profit from that? They're going to have that tailwind because governments have made it perfectly clear that they're not actually intending on doing this work themselves. They're expecting private enterprise to do that. So there's going to be a lot of money flowing into this over the years. So you could back a fund that's involved in that. And we talked about some of this a couple of podcasts back, if people want to go searching for it, about green investing and some of the investment trusts that invest in companies that are solving, you know, environmental problems. Then you've got food and agriculture, ties in to the climate change issue, but also ties into the growing global population, the need for food, the need for water, the way some of this stuff is changing. But it's not just food. It's not just what we're producing, what we're eating. It's also the packaging. So there's a big push for much more recyclable packaging or net zero packaging or things like that. And there's some really interesting stuff going on in the packaging space, which sounds like the most ridiculous sentence anybody has ever spoken. But there is, you know, really interesting things going on there. The emerging market consumer. Emerging markets are seeing a dramatic growth in the middle class. And what happens in economies when you get a dramatic growth in the middle class is you get a dramatic growth in spending. Could you tap into that? Healthcare, we've already spoken about how that is dramatically changing. We've seen it with the vaccines, which are using a new way of doing a vaccine. And I'm not going to go any further into that because I don't understand this stuff. But immunotherapy, all these different kind of rapid development in the way that we treat people in a more personalized way rather than the large, bigger picture way. And then to include some more, robotics, infrastructure, cryptocurrencies, and digital payments, big gamble there, you know, but, you know, maybe you're better off with a fund that's tapping into some of these ideas than you are just staking it all on Ethereum or Bitcoin. Artificial intelligence, and then just overall disruption, by which I don't mean someone walking into a quiet room and shouting. It's looking at companies that are disrupting, looking at companies that are going to change things, the ones that are going to really shake things up. The most successful example of an investment trust in this country that targets that is Scottish Mortgage, obviously, you know, but there are some others that go and look at doing similar things.
Helen, what does your instinct, your gut tell you?
I think it feels exciting, doesn't it, to be putting your money into things that can potentially change the world, especially if you're one of these new investors that's only just got into it recently during lockdown, perhaps. I just probably sound a note of caution not to get kind of carried away necessarily with these sort of big idea type things. As Simon said, a lot of these new sort of tech type companies, they can fluctuate quite a lot in terms of the share price. So I think, you know, absolutely go for it, place a bet on those, but maybe don't forget about the sort of boring shares that will just give you a nice little dividend and kind of keep ticking over, I think, as well.
Reflecting on what Helen said is what you need to do is you need to look at the makeup of the global stock market. So for example, if you look at one of the global stock market indices like the MSCI or World Index, what you'll find is that 60% of that roughly is made up of the US, about 6% is Japan, about 4% is the UK, and so on, those individual markets. And if you invest into one of those gigantic global trackers, you are effectively just backing the global stock market. And the more you veer away from that, the more you are backing an individual country, sector, region, idea. So if you think that climate change and robotics are going to be the two overwhelming themes that define the next 10 to 15 years, and you put half your money into a green, you know, targeting climate change investment trust or fund, and the other half into a robotics one, you're taking a colossal bet on only the companies that do that stuff, and you are ignoring all of those other ones that I just mentioned. So it's the kind of thing where, as Helen said there, you want to take a little bit of your portfolio and allocate it to it, maybe 5%, 10%. You want to dabble around the edges. If you're allocating all of your portfolio to it, then you just need to be aware that the risks you are taking are way out of whack with the normal risk that you have from investing in the stock market.
All right. Well, I want to ask you, Simon, about investing, but in something else, property. What's property going to look like in all its forms, Simon? Because we'll get into buy to let again in a second, but property?
Property is expensive, is the caveat that I would offer to anybody considering investing in property. We've had a report this morning from Nationwide house prices. The average house price is up £16,000 over the past year to a new record high. And if you look at it compared to wages, it's nearly as expensive as it's ever been. So before you invest in property, you need to bear that in mind. Doesn't mean you won't make money. Doesn't mean prices won't continue to go up, but there's not the headroom for them to go up as there is when prices are cheap. And that's true of any investment. The momentum can continue. Expensive stuff can continue to get more expensive, but there just doesn't exist the headroom there. So you need to look at very carefully at what you're buying, where you're buying it, whether there are opportunities to add value, what the rental return would be, and listen to the big discussion that we had about buy-to-let last week on the podcast. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to continue with buy-to-let and do listen to that, but we're going to slightly change tack in where. And I was having a conversation with my landlord. I live in quite a touristy area, who was saying that, you know, this place in the past was a buy-to-let, and some of the people he knows on this street, also buy-to-let, are charging and getting away with 2-3 times what they would normally charge. But is it going to last, Helen? Is investing in buy-to-let, a holiday let, a canny investment? On the face of it, as Simon says, property prices going up, people wanting to move, all that sort of thing. Are we able to travel and fly about? We don't know. Bit risky. Maybe another year in staycation Britain. But will it continue? Canny investment?
I mean, certainly as we keep hearing, we're set for this big staycation summer once again this year. Bookings have absolutely rocketed. I think some of the sort of third-party booking companies have said that their bookings are up 200% on even on this time last year when they were very high. So it's obviously going to be huge this summer. You know, you make very good returns from a holiday let, much, much better normally than buy-to-let when it's occupied. But you have to obviously be aware that if you're buying a holiday let, perhaps for certain months of the year, it will be unoccupied. A week's rent on a holiday let is much, much higher than what you would get for a week of a standard buy-to-let property. But it's seasonal, and also there is so much kind of hands-on management that you have to do, or you have to pay someone else to do that for you. It's not easy. I mean, you think you've got to go in and turn it around every time someone stayed there. There's all kinds of insurance complications and things that you've got to deal with. It's not easy. You've essentially got to be on call all the time. If you think about, you know, when you go on holiday, you want to have a great time, and if something goes wrong, you are going to be on the phone to the person who's let you that in the middle of the night, telling them to come round and fix the boiler. You know, people are really picky about their holidays. So it can be a good investment, but it's very demanding on your time.
Simon, your views on this, holiday lets? Is it easy to get a mortgage? I mean, how much tax do you have to pay as well?
Well, there's a number of mortgages that specifically target holiday lets, and it's an area that's growing, actually, one that Helen's been writing about recently. You do need to bear in mind that you will have to pay tax. Yes, that is a factor. And that you're probably going to need a bigger deposit than you obviously would do with a normal residential mortgage. Some of the holiday let mortgages will take into account potential rental income in different ways. You need to weigh up the fact that you may or may not be able to rent that place out all year round, and that demand may fluctuate, but it's got a hell of a lot easier to do this kind of thing thanks to the rise of the internet holiday lettings websites. You know, you would have been absolutely beholden to an agent, a holiday let agent, maybe even 15 years ago, whereas now you can very easily put it up and do it yourself, but there is work involved. You do need to do the changeover. It does need to be nice. You want to get those good reviews on whichever one of the holiday letting websites you decide to use, not terrible reviews from people saying it was filthy. They clearly hadn't cleaned up after the last people and so on. And so that then comes down to the, do you want to be doing that yourself? Is it possible? Because you might not live in that location as well. Or do you need to pay someone else to do it? And you need to factor in all those costs and how they're going to eat into it. And also, I think one of the main mistakes people make with these sometimes is massively overestimating the amount of time that they might spend there or times that they might go visit. They think how wonderful it would be to have that place at the coast that they could go to every weekend. And they don't go there every weekend. Also, one of the things that always puts me off is I can barely keep up with the stuff I need to do on the house I actually live in. How I'd manage to keep up with the stuff I'd need to do on another property as well, I just do not know.
And Helen, you mentioned it there. Look, how long is staycationing and this trend going to last? I don't know about anyone else, but I have spent a year not dreaming about going to Bognor or wherever. It is lovely, by the way, I've been. All I want to do as soon as we're allowed is fly somewhere.
Yeah, I completely agree. Going to Norfolk doesn't really hold a huge amount of attraction for me personally. But, you know, this summer, it sounds like it is going to be the way to go. Looking further than that, I guess it will depend a lot on how much of a price increase we see on foreign holidays. Obviously, things like the airline companies have lost so much money in the last year. Prices for things like flights are going to have to go up, hotels as well. It's going to become really expensive to go abroad. So some people, you know, whether they kind of like it or not, might end up having to do a staycation. Clearly it's not going to be like this summer every summer, but you know, maybe people will kind of fall in love with going to the English coast again. You know, they've been forced to do it for a couple of summers. Maybe some people will just decide they like it and carry on. But it's this absolute boom is clearly a very forced thing, and it's not going to go on forever.
Where are the most popular places that we've seen?
I think the obvious ones, sort of Devon, Cornwall, the kind of obvious candidates, but then places like the Peak District, the Cotswolds, those you know, pretty little touristy towns, everyone seems to be quite into those. Wales also, I think, doing quite well. So generally the usual kind of candidates that you'd expect, but I think people are going to have to start looking at maybe locations that they hadn't considered before, just because things are getting booked up so quickly. And again, you know, staycations are getting expensive too. So, you know, you might have to look slightly more off the beaten track unless you want to pay. I mean, there's been stories of some holiday cottages charging like tens of thousands of pounds for a week. So it's all going a bit mad. So you might, yeah. Some people might need to kind of temper their expectations, even from holidaying in the UK.
Well, round my way then, two or three times the normal price is a bargain. Simon?
Yes, I think a lot of people are going to have to end up having a real staycation, potentially, where they just stay in their house. Because if last year is anything to go by, and I think actually this year is worse, you can't get a decent place to stay for love nor money. So I think a lot of people are just going to end up having to stay at home. So maybe you need to be creative, work out how you have a holiday at home, or can you find someone in the same position as you? Do you have a friend or family member who lives somewhere different and also can't find anywhere to staycation? And could you swap? Could you do some kind of house swap or something? And we went on holiday for a week. I'm a fully committed holiday abroad kind of person because I like two things. I like snow because I like snowboarding and skiing. And you don't really get enough of that in this country to qualify. And the great as Scotland is, it's not the Alps. And I like sunshine and hot weather. And whilst we do get some lovely days, and when the sun is shining, there is no more beautiful place to be than England or the UK, England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, wherever, you know. Unfortunately, the sun is nowhere near as reliable as I would like it to be, and neither is the temperature in this country. So I'm quite committed to going abroad. But I had a great week in Norfolk last year, and the weather was okay. It was kind of sunny and dry, and it was kind of warm, but not that warm. But we had a fabulous time. And I must admit, I'd very gladly go back for a week. And I looked at the house that we rented, but it wasn't available. Someone else had booked it.
That's a shame. No, I think I've just been... affected by the fact that I, apart from being born in another country and all that sort of thing, didn't really go abroad on holiday ever as a child. I think the first time was when I was 15 and randomly went to Denmark. So maybe it's now I'm just trying to make up for it, but some wonderful holidays to be had. So I'm not criticizing that. I am just itching to travel again. Helen, itching to travel again. And one area where we could invest in property is quite literally in our homes. Simon, you mentioned it earlier, where we're spending our money, doing up our homes. If you've waited to do up your bathroom or install a new kitchen or anything, you may have to wait a while longer. Helen, why is this the case?
So part of it is that obviously lots of people have bought a new home this year, and understandably they want to do it up. So there's this sort of short-term demand, you know, tradespeople who come to sort of fit your kitchen, fit your bathroom, they're very sort of booked up. So that's causing delays of weeks, months for some people. But there's also an interesting longer-term sort of issue, which is that we've basically got a shortage of skilled people to do the job. So this isn't just a lockdown thing. This is a sort of longer term worry. So there's a few companies that are trying to do apprenticeship schemes to try and get people into these jobs. So I think Wix is doing one, which is good. But it's you know, younger people don't seem to really be wanting to go into these trades as much, which is which is causing a bit of a knock-on effect for people who want to get their kitchen done.
Indeed. I should say the HomeServe Foundation are also trying to do great work here. But Simon, this is a concern, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's a concern for anybody who's tried to find somebody to do that kind of work in the past and struggled. So if it's going to get even harder, it's even more of a concern. And we spoke to the British Institute of Kitchen, Bedroom and Bathroom Installation, who put out a report on this. And they said that their survey of over 3,000 installers showed that a third of sole trader installers plan on retiring from the industry within the next 10 years. So that is going to get much worse. And Damian Walters, the chief executive of Bigby, said these alarming figures remove any remaining doubts about the scale of the challenge our industry faces over the coming years. Put bluntly, we've relied for too long on an aging workforce who are now looking forward to their retirement. We need to pull out all the stops to prepare a new generation of skilled installers ready to take their place. I bet what actually happens is a lot of those people end up working well into their retirement, because a lot of the tradesmen and women I know do tend to end up doing that. They're still working away, putting people's bathrooms and kitchens in well past the age of 65.
Indeed. I don't know about you, Helen. I've seen Grand Designs and all those sort of, you know, home shows. You could do it yourself, couldn't you? I'm guessing not. How much is all of
this? No, probably
gonna
not.
Cost us?
Yeah, so there's been some research out this week from Churchill Home Insurance. Boxed jobs in the home cost us in the UK £609 million annually. So that's an average of £141 per job. So it can cost a lot if you screw it up. I mean, it just depends what you're doing, doesn't it? It's, you know, I've kind of fixed my washing machine from watching a plumber on a YouTube video. It's some things you can have a go. But if it's anything big and you don't have any experience, it's just not a good idea. Get in a professional. You probably have to wait a while. But it's probably worth the wait rather than screwing up and having to start again and pay someone to fix it.
Good work, Helen. Well done on fixing your washing machine after watching a YouTube video.
Yeah.
A shout out to my sister-in-law as well, who fixed her kitchen tap in a similar way. She got fed up of it not working properly and decided to fix the tap and actually managed to do it. So hats off to people who do that kind of thing.
Yeah, well done.
Say it was absolutely disgusting. draining a washing machine is not a pleasant experience, but it saved me calling my landlord. It took all of about 15 minutes and I learned a new skill, so I was happy.
One thing I do want to ask you before I let you go, though, it's another sort of property related, but it's a bit of a myth about fences. I found this, I don't know why I found this such an interesting article and why I don't even have a blooming garden fence, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless that you had a reader question, which was garden fence toppled down, whose responsibility is it? And I always thought it was to the left, as a lot of people thought. If it's to the left, it's your responsibility. This apparently is rubbish.
Completely false. No truth in the to the left thing whatsoever. Urban legend, absolute nonsense. It could be anyone's. Well, it can't be anyone's. I mean, it's unlikely to be just some random person who lives somewhere completely different. Yeah. The chances are it's going to be yours or your neighbour's. But there's no rhyme or reason to it. You need to check your property deeds, and they will either say it, or you might have a little T mark, which indicates whose responsibility it is. Or in many cases, there might be nothing to say whose responsibility it is. Mm. And then it comes down to either trying to find a point of mutual agreement and cooperation, or just putting your hand in your pocket and paying for it yourself if you're the one who's really bothered and the other person isn't interested. And this is the kind of thing that can lead to endless disputes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it might just be worth putting your hand in your pocket if it's causing you a real problem. The best thing to do about it is to approach your neighbour. If you can't establish whose responsibility it is, to approach your neighbour, ask them if they know whose responsibility it is, but say you think the responsibility is shared because you don't have the information that says it's yours and you don't have the information that says it's theirs. And say, I'd like to replace the fence. We think it's in a bad condition. Shall we pay 50-50? Now, if everything goes to plan, they'll say yes, and you split the cost. If they say, I don't have any problem with that fence that's fallen down, I don't think it's my responsibility. If you want to replace it, you can replace it, but I'm not interested, then you're going to have to either pay all of the cost yourself or get involved in a potentially lengthy dispute. And I would advise people not to get involved in potentially lengthy disputes with their neighbours.
Will insurance cover it?
Highly unlikely. Sometimes they will do if a storm or something like that, but there's excess. A lot of times fences just they just go. They've got a limited life. A fence doesn't last forever. Or you might have creepers or ivy or something that takes it down. It might have a branch that falls onto it or something like that. And it just comes down to having to sort it out.
And wasn't I right in thinking that even if it is in the deeds, that it's their responsibility, well, there's nothing actually you can do to necessarily force them to pay?
Well, you can try to force them to pay. But yeah, I mean, do you really want to get involved with kind of solicitors and threats and things like that? Not really. I think in most cases, if something is somebody else's responsibility, then you'd hope that they would do the honourable thing and sort it out. But, you know, it's only if it's a danger and your neighbour is refusing to take responsibility that you can report it to your local council, who may be able to enforce your neighbour to take action. And I guess may might be the word doing heavy lifting in that sentence.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just not worth it, is it? All right, then. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read comments.
You can keep up with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.